You're listening to Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 AM, radiosandysprings.com on the net, and it's time for Inside the Black Box. And we've I sent out a challenge to I don't know how many different chat groups and science groups and all this kind of stuff. We'll see if they pay any attention to their chat groups, because I challenged them to stump the two doctors from Georgia Tech. Ask any question under the sun, how it works, what it does, what you put in it to make it work, and how long will it work after you put the stuff in
we'll
to
take,
make it work.
And we'll take one piece of clothing off for everyone we get
yes,
wrong.
Yes, this will be like Stump the Band on
wait,
the Tonight
wait, wait,
Show.
Wait, wait,
no,
wait,
I'm just kidding, David. David's got to sit in here and look at this, so he's vetoing that. As
so
station owner, he's going to veto that.
Now, we could do something else. You can give me a dollar for each time they stump you or something.
I don't have that much money.
I got kids I have to send to college.
So. Okay. Well, anyway, so we sent out this thing, and we'll see if anybody reads their chat mail and all that kind of stuff and sends back a question or calls in a question for you. And I'm going to turn it over to you guys and go do some work right quick.
All right.
All right, so good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Inside the Black Box, Radio Sandy Springs' weekly show on science and technology. And as you just heard, apparently, Bill, we've put out a grand challenge.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking maybe this the way this should work is you know, if they stump us, we'll put a piece of clothing on.
Oh, that would be good.
That'll get a lot more response.
The public in general would applaud that.
I think so.
So I'm Pete Ledevis here with my co-host, Bill Hunt. And if you are interested in taking part in our grand challenge, you can give us a call at 404-943-1620. Once again, that number is 404-943-1620. Or if you're outside the Sandy Springs or Atlanta calling area, you can call us toll-free at 866-356-0789.
Should we give them the U.S. country code for the folks listening down in Patagonia?
We do have a big following there, don't we?
We do.
Right. You were doing some tours there recently?
Yes. The comedy tour. Yes.
But and of course,
and there's also the upcoming Inside the Black Box, the musical. We got that.
Oh, really? We're putting it to music.
We're putting that together.
That scares me more than you'll ever know.
I know.
And, of course, if you're listening to us online at www.radiosandysprings.com, both those numbers are listed on the website. So feel free to give us a call about anything and everything. And
because we don't know anything.
Yeah, I'm willing to just say most of the questions we won't be able to answer.
Yeah.
But this much I will say for us, Bill, and that is that both our car talk show you heard this morning, as well as Bill and I, we do this live and unrehearsed,
and
gentlemen. There's no prompting. There's no notes.
There's also very little preparation.
Look, I have a lot of random paper scattered in front of me, and I don't know what any of them say. But it's my understanding, and I think you were the one that told me that, do the car guys on NPR, a lot of their questions are pre-screened.
Right. So the whole, I mean, it sounds like, dang, they know everything, you know, but actually it's all pre-screened, and they've come up with the answer and all that, so it seems like.
Right.
You know,
we're not even going to pretend.
No,
we'll admit right out, we know very little.
But, you know, it's kind of interesting. I was in a meeting yesterday, and
you were in a meeting? You go to those things.
And it happens.
Okay.
And so, you know, somebody was asking about my research and said, you know, do you think there are any surprises left? It was the dog on a chip thing that I was in Time Magazine for. And I was going, well, there may be. I can't rule out that there are surprises. And, you know, somebody else, oh, you shouldn't say that you're going to be surprised. Well, maybe. You got to keep an open – you always have to keep an open mind.
Why were they upset that you said you'd be surprised?
This was, you know, sort of, well, it's a...
Was this a guy with an MBA? That's my first
question.
Okay,
yes.
Well, there you have it.
Yes. I mean, he was, you know, it was not a scientific meeting. It was an MBA business type. And, but the thing is, you know, and I was saying to him, I was sort of like, look, I hope to be surprised the rest of my career.
Right. As well you should.
You know, I mean, there's that sense of discovery and, and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's, maybe it's a choice of words, but, you got to keep your mind open to, you know, what you thought was there was, you know, something different.
Yeah, and that is, after all, the nature of scientific research and development.
Right.
The problem is, from my time in industry, you have business managers that want to schedule research.
Yes.
And they think, well, if I throw this much money at it, I will get an innovation every 1.6 years.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, they think, you know, how long is it going to take to come up with equals MC squared or something
right,
like that.
Right, exactly.
I mean, a good example would be in the late 80s, the discovery of the high-temperature superconductors. Mm-hmm. And so you might have asked, and people were, you know, when are we going to have a theory for this new?
Right. And every week someone was close to breaking that barrier.
And the answer is that even today they still don't know.
Yeah, and by high-temperature superconductors, ladies and gentlemen, we mean something that will superconduct at, like, liquid nitrogen temperatures, not liquid helium.
Right, and superconducting means that, you know, you have no resistance for a material that at room temperature would have quite a bit of resistance.
Right, so you can pump an unbelievable amount of current through essentially the wire.
Right.
And what people are thinking is, well, Bill, why do I care about high-temperature superconductors? And the truth is, most of the magnets used in MRI machines.
Magnets, not maggots, but go ahead.
Yeah. Most of those magnets are high-temperature superconductors.
They don't use maggots in MRI machines.
They don't?
It's
the old version.
The old version, yeah.
I haven't had any caffeine morning. What do you got, the three-gallon Subway thing of iced tea?
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
So that's my excuse. What's yours?
Yeah, I have no idea.
But in any case, if you have an MRI, what makes that technology practical is this theory of superconductivity.
Right.
Right.
Right. So these huge magnetic fields.
Right. Yeah, because basically you put a high current through a bunch of wires wrapped in a circle, and that's what gives you the magnetic field.
Right. Right.
Okay, so we should probably recap last week's show where we had Dr. Facundo Fernandez, which I love, right?
Yeah. Well, see, he's actually from Kansas, but he couldn't get those chicks with the normal name, so he came up with this whole Argentinian.
And your theory is that's why he has a hot girlfriend?
Yeah, I think so. It's just the name.
Because it just sounds like Antonio Banderas.
Yeah, no, it's just the name. It's not, you know, he's like Fred Smith, you know, but he wasn't getting anywhere with that.
But he's a charming guy.
He is.
So he's very, not quite as nerdy as we are.
Right.
But so last week we talked with Dr. Fernandez about counterfeit drugs.
Yeah, and I learned a lot. I mean, I thought it was kind of interesting how pervasive this is.
And how insidious was the word you used. If you're going to
far
make
more malicious than drug dealers in a
counterfeit version of Viagra or Cialis, well, you'll know pretty much right away if that's not working. But malarial drugs, which you talked about specifically, that's terrible.
Or cancer drugs.
Yeah,
or
you'll end up dying.
Probably HIV drugs in Africa. There's a lot of counterfeit. You know, things like that where it's really making a big should be making a big difference.
So. Right. So the lesson I think we learned was if it's significantly cheaper than the regular form of that drug, be suspicious. It may be a counterfeit. Look at the packaging, which they're even circumventing now as well.
Yeah, Ziploc bags with pills in them. Yeah.
And while not all online pharmacies are nasty, you want to be a little wary of online pharmacies.
Yeah, we also learned that if you order Viagra online, you'll be hounded by sales reps from India.
Right, much like Dr. Fernandez is to this day.
Right, right.
So now, he did it, of course, for an experiment.
That's what he said.
And, gentlemen, if you're out there and your wife finds the
always
credit card receipt for that,
call it an experiment.
Yeah, and say, I'm working with this guy, Dr. Facundo Fernandez at Georgia Tech.
Even just saying it a little.
Yeah, I just, right, that just
that'll
saying
improve
it,
your chances right there.
Okay, all right, now that we've forayed into the depths of sophomoric cheap humor.
Yes.
So let's come back and maybe talk a little bit about science in the news.
Okay.
And what everyone's talking about, I'm looking at a couple articles in front of me, is this whole polonium-210 thing.
And that whole issue, so this is related to the ex-KGB guy, right?
Yes, this is related to, I can't even pronounce his name, Litvinenko? Litvinenko. And his contact is being tested as well. So supposedly he was poisoned by polonium-210.
Right, and so this is sort of, to me, it's something that would have happened in the Cold War era, and it almost, this sort of almost sounds like those stories of the Japanese soldiers, on a, island someplace still fighting the war 15 years after it was over with. I mean, wasn't this all over with, killing agents that had, but anyway, go ahead.
Well, but see, I figured they thought, it's not a typical poison, right? It's quite rare to get enough to kill someone. The body burden that you can withstand is in the picogram quantity. So that's a few trillionths of a gram. Yeah, that was actually in one of these articles.
Whoa.
A number of times. So you can't take much of it. But I guess what bothers me about all the stories is they keep talking about polonium-210. And someone even called the chemical and biomolecular engineering department from one of the TV stations and said, who can talk about the pathology of ingesting polonium-210. And they talk about it, but they never tell you what the heck's going on.
Yeah.
And I guess this has always bothered me, right? Mm-hmm. That one of these things I saw on a poster in graduate school, that any sufficiently advanced technology cannot be distinguished from magic. That the way we report science and technology is, ooh, this magical thing called polonium-210. So they never bother to tell you that, well, it's radioactive because it's way down in the periodic table. Gosh, I have that out here somewhere. But the 210 simply refers to its molecular weight.
Right.
And polonium actually has 84 protons. That's what makes it polonium.
Mm-hmm.
And that means it's way down in the periodic table. And that means there's a good chance it is radioactive. That means that its nucleus is not stable. And I believe it was Leo Szilard, I'm probably not pronouncing that right, the radiochemist who was involved in the Manhattan Project, who first described it.
Is this the dude that hung out in the bathtub?
No.
Okay.
Oh, yes, it is. Yeah, it is the dude that hung out in the bathtub.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it was.
So he's weirder than us to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, it was in Richard Rhodes' book, The Making of the Bomb.
Oh, The Making of the Atomic Bomb.
Yeah, people would
excellent
come in,
book, by the way.
Yeah, people would come in and talk to him, and he'd be like in the tub. Okay. Not with a bathing suit.
Yeah, so that I did read that book. I don't remember the bathtub scenes. Yeah. Obviously, you have a different mindset.
Well, some of us kind of zoom in on certain aspects, so we don't skim.
Yes.
We get some really good
you
skim.
You really get the juicy parts
yes,
of
I
that
do.
Book.
Yes, I do. Right.
Yeah, and actually, to be honest, that's a good book for lay people as well that talks about the beginnings of radiochemistry and our understanding of nuclear radioactivity. Mm-hmm. The Making of the Atomic Bomb by Richard Rhodes. It did win the Pulitzer Prize. I recommend it highly.
Yeah.
Very, very good. So the polonium-210, when they say, uranium-285, or what is it? Is it
235? 235.
235 and 238, right.
Right?
That's the molecular weight, and that refers to the number of neutrons that are in there.
Right.
And usually there's a naturally occurring
one. So hold
on.
In terms of molecular weight, so it's really a counting of
protons and
particles.
Neutrons.
So it's what's the total number of
protons
and neutrons in the nucleus. So
U-235
has 235 total protons and neutrons, and 238 has three more neutrons. No more protons.
Yeah. The protons are what make it the element that it is.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
So when they say polonium, that means 84 protons, period.
And, interestingly, that was the first radioactive material discovered by the Curies, Madame Curie.
Oh, yeah. Actually, the history, they
and
do explain
she
that.
Was... from Poland, so this is sort of named after.
Oh, is that
Poland.
What is named after? Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
So,
little known, uninteresting fact. See, nobody would ask me that as a trivia question. I got that nailed, but they'll ask
me
something else.
So you're ready to go on Jeopardy.
I'm ready to start putting
all right,
my clothes back on.
Dave's back in here, which means we're overdue to take a station break. So we'll continue talking about polonium after we come back from this quick break. You're listening to Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 AM and RadioSandySprings.com.
Now I will go in here and look at my computer and see what it says about removable. I assume that's what.
Yeah.
And yes, there it is. Do you want to play it now?
No.
Can we play it a little later in the show? So basically, when you come back from one of the breaks, we'll do it right after the break when you're here.
The next one, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. We can.
You know,
it
I
anyway.
Keep telling you guys, we really got to break down and get a producer for this show. You know, somebody that producer, director,
Lon,
somebody run the board, somebody go get coffee.
Yeah, we need that.
We
croissants.
Do.
I'm useless without a croissant, you know.
Just one?
I'm probably useless with a croissant, but.
Indeed you are.
Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, back to the show. Here we go.
Are we back?
We're back.
Okay.
Live.
Notice that smooth and professional transition.
Yes, hardly noticed.
That's called a segue.
Okay. And we're comedians, so we don't know much about segues.
Segway, which is Latin for brick wall.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, so we were talking about just a riveting topic before the break, polonium-210. And the thing about the molecular weight is, if you look up on the periodic table, you say, why don't I see 210 for the molecular weight? In fact, probably what you see is 209 point something.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always a distribution, right? So carbon is mainly 12, but there's carbon-13, there's carbon-14, which we use in carbon dating. There's probably a carbon-11. But in any case, there's a distribution of these things, and things like polonium-210 or uranium-235, which is a little less stable. What Leo pointed out is think of these things like soap bubbles. that, in fact, when a soap bubble gets real big, you can hit it and actually smack it in two.
Mm-hmm.
And when a soap bubble's really, really small, you can get two of them to coalesce together into one soap bubble. Hmm. That's what fission and fusion is.
Huh.
And the middle-of-the-road soap bubble, the one that's most stable, is the number 55 molecular weight of iron. So some people postulate that someday at the thermal death of the universe, we're just going to have a bunch of iron 55 floating around.
And the heavy metal people will be happy about that.
The steel industry will be happy. But that's exactly what that is. And the reason people aren't too concerned about all this polonium contamination all over the airplanes, which they're finding now, and we've got a little bit on security screening at the airlines we're going to talk about in a minute, is because it is an alpha emitter. Because it's unstable, the soap bubble sort of...
What is an alpha?
It means
particle?
That when it becomes unstable and spits off part of the nucleus, what it spits off is an alpha particle. And that is a high speed, that's what makes it bad, it's the high speed part, helium nucleus. So it's got two protons and two neutrons. And I suppose a few of them could have three neutrons and things like that. That comes off at very, very high speed. But because that's at least, a reasonably sized particle, it doesn't penetrate your skin too well. As opposed to radiation, like gamma radiation, which does. So this thing isn't particularly dangerous unless you ingest it. So that's why it's such a great poison, because it doesn't really hurt anyone.
I don't like the way you say great poison.
Okay, well, you know what I mean. So,
yeah, that's something that you ought to talk about, is that spy that...
Yeah, that's what
we're talking about.
It seems like it's out of time that a KGB, expatriate is murdered,
But I think, they're old school. KGB is old school, so maybe that's why they do that. And this is opposed to other elements. My understanding is that plutonium, while also being radioactive, which is bad, and it's the radiation that kills you, it damages tissue, it causes most organs to swell, it causes this edema, and that's how you die. But plutonium, regardless of its radioactivity, is just a very toxic metal as well. But polonium, I believe, only kills because of the radiation.
Mm.
Now, to this end, the Brits are very worried now. They're finding contaminations of these all over airplanes, and they're telling people don't worry too much unless you've ingested it. Now, Bill, you've got a news item on new security.
This is the thing I've said all along, though, and, one of the places the guy didn't know was the sushi bar. I've said all along, sushi will kill you.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
I had sushi last night, too.
And you look
maybe
terrible.
That's why I look like crap. Okay.
I was on a trip to Japan a number of years ago, and they had a special dinner for those of us involved in planning the conference. And one of the people that was involved was a woman who was pregnant, and she'd been told by her doctor that she can't eat any of the sushi when she's over there because of the parasites that are in the sushi.
Yeah, that's the biggest problem with sushi. Right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
because if you cook it, you're killing a lot of parasites.
Yeah,
one
tip for the Japanese, fire, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Heat.
Get flints and,
there you go.
Get things going. But Friday in the USA Today, it was...
the last bastion of pure journalism.
I was going to say, my co-host, he brings in stuff from the New York Times, Atlantic Monthly. I'm talking USA Today and Weekly
Reader. No, that's okay.
Weekly
news
Reader.
Is news.
But,
I'm a big fan of the Weekly
Reader this week. He's just a higher class guy, that's all. But anyway, the TSA is putting out there now these X-ray machines, and one's in the Phoenix airport. And so it can see underneath your clothes to see if you've got a plastic explosive as opposed to a metal
which they could detect.
Explosive,
right.
And so actually what it does, it's what every teenager has wanted, teenage boy anyway, has wanted to have, is it just sees you without your clothes on.
All right, but is it an accurate picture? Is it,
yeah.
Okay.
Wow. Now, that's good sometimes, but like going to the French Riviera where they're topless, they don't have any restrictions about grandma, getting out there topless, as I found out, sadly.
All right, you are not kidding us. This is actually
No. And wow. So there's obviously all sorts of potential for abuse or, videos that will be posted on the web, and every time Pamela Anderson goes through, she gets stopped, and that's what I was going to think. You have a cheaper version, and guests come into your home, for a party.
Not worried about the X-ray exposure. I mean, basically, what you're describing is a fluoroscope. Right? These are these video X-rays,
right?
X-rays aren't quite as high in energy as an alpha particle, but they are enough so that we worry
Well,
about
supposedly
it.
They're not going to screen everybody, but frankly, it's always bothered me. You go to the dentist, and they're sticking the stuff in you, but they get the hell out of the room. And
well, of course.
Yeah. You know,
who's the dummy in the chair?
Hey, come back here.
They put on the lead apron.
Right, yeah, they're gone. They just, any kind of x-ray. So, yeah, I would hope that they've looked through the health issues, potential health issues. But, you know, obviously it's, certainly going to be an opportunity for abuse there.
Wait a second, though. You kids are too young to remember.
Oh, I like it when he calls me kid.
Oh, man. Go ahead.
But, you know, Buster Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're not going to talk about the foot x-rays back in the 40s.
You know what? I'm not too young.
Yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
They
did a thing on
still
that
in
on
the
TV.
50s, I think,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the point is...
Well, we haven't told the story, so go ahead and finish, David. Tell us what that was.
Well, you went in and you stuck your feet...
To a shoe store.
In a box, in this machine.
Yeah, and you got your feet x-rayed.
And you inserted a nickel. I mean, it was like a curiosity thing, right?
No. It depends. As I remember, and I was, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8, somewhere in that neighborhood. As I remember, the shoe store did it as a sales tool.
Yeah.
Let's make sure that...
The fit was right.
And the bones are in the right place.
Oh, so you see the shoe and where your foot was and all that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so they did it as a sales tool.
Right.
But I don't know.
Well, so the biggest problem with those things was not so much... I mean, the x-ray exposure is a concern, but the biggest problem was they were unshielded. So they had the x-rays come down on your foot, but it was just wood around it. It wasn't lead lined. Uh-huh. I mean, a modern x-ray diffraction machine, a modern x-ray machine, it focuses in a very tight beam, and it's all shielded around there.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever they turned that machine on, x-rays were flying all over the room. So if you worked in a shoe store and you're having problems now, perhaps you might want to think about a class action suit.
Yeah, several two-headed kids.
So that was the problem.
Yeah.
But you mentioned that the reason they're going to do this is to detect plastic explosives,
right?
So why are plastic explosives so hard to detect?
Well,
should we talk about the way a metal detector works? You're an electrical engineer. How does a metal detector work?
Well, it's a perturbation of the electromagnetic
field. Okay, that's what I would guess.
And so a plastic is not going to change what the electromagnetic field looks like, so it's not going to get picked up.
So it measures this magnetic field, and if you put something in it that suddenly conducts that magnetic field, the magnetic field...
Changes the field.
Is it, what do they call it, permittivity or permeability?
Permittivity, very good.
Is it permittivity?
Permeability is the magnetic...
Yeah, so with the magnetic field, and basically they're in a big door, so this is just a big coil that's making a magnetic field.
Yes.
If you put most things in there, they don't conduct the magnetic field or any better than air.
Except a pacemaker.
Except metal. Iron, for example, has 5,000
times.
Plate
I've got in my head. That kind
of thing, And now, let me ask you this, though. Isn't that how the stoplight triggers work? Whenever I see, they've carved out of the
pavement.
They've
got triggers on them?
Well, you know what I mean, where they tell if there's a car there in the left turn lane. There's always some, you can see the little seam where they chisel stuff out. Okay. I always assume this is a big coil of wires. We've got a current running through it. It generates a magnetic field.
I would just
field.
Go by weight.
But do you really think it goes by weight?
I don't know.
I'm assuming you get this giant piece of iron over it, and boom, suddenly the magnetic field changes.
I always thought it was they had a camera, they saw it was me, and they just... Don't change it for a long time.
You have a conspiracy attitude.
I don't know. Talking about your x-ray thing, back in the... I can't remember.
You don't have to admit how the Triassic period. That's
When was the big... before the terrorism, but we had all the plane hijackings. And
the 70s. It was like every week somebody was hijacking a plane someplace.
And one of the things that they had, that somebody had come out with was the plastic gun.
Right.
And they couldn't.
Yeah,
know,
the metal detector
wasn't
going to
do anything with the plastic gun.
Yeah. Well, also, there are very well. I don't want to get into details, but so. If the components of any of these things is plastic and they're looking for metal, they're not going to find it.
Right.
But they can with this, you know.
Excellent.
There obviously are some privacy
issues. If you're walking through the airport, not you per se, but just hypothetically, you're wearing ladies' undergarments, they're going to pick that up.
Yeah, yeah.
And point at you.
Yeah, and laugh. If you're walking out of the X-ray machine and the dudes are cracking up, then you shouldn't have been wearing that thong to the airport.
That is a scary, scary thing. All right. Did we miss our break at 20 after? Do you want to do that now?
Yeah, we can.
All right, we're going to take a break. You'll be back with just raucous comedy here on Inside the Black Box. On
and the occasional science thing.
There you go.
We're back with Inside the Black Box, talking off mic about chemistry. And anyway, this guy had worked for Texaco for 400 years, and he said, you know, why would you take down the most important tool that you ever... I had one chemistry instructor at Tech that, I mean, he put blinds up, he painted over the walls, and I mean, everything before we took a test. He wasn't about to have the periodic table within...
Should have that up, absolutely.
Yeah, and this guy said, why would somebody take it down? This is this is your tool. This is...
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. It has to deal with sort of the different levels of knowledge you can teach someone. And I think most of us, Bill would probably back me up on this, want our students to get to the point where they can synthesize knowledge. They can take concept A, concept B, put them together, and come up with a new approach to something. Mm-hmm. We don't want to test, have you memorize the isotopes of polonium, because, and you know, maybe that'll help you in some respect, but... As a chemist, as an electrical engineer, you can go to the radio frequency handbook. You can look up bolts. You can look up, what was it, the permittivity of a magnetic field in iron.
Right.
You know, so I think Einstein was asked once by a young boy that, you know, what's the speed of light? He said, you know, I don't really know, but any schoolboy can tell you where to look that up. I mean, to him, it was always C.
Yeah.
You know, 3 times 10^8 meters per second, but who cares about the number?
Well, I think it's good to have
orders of magnitude,
in mind for things. But, I remember, you know, a short-lived attempt to take P-Chem as an undergraduate. I didn't need to or have to, but I got, like, docked 10 points because I couldn't remember the Rydberg constant.
Oh, I can't remember that. This is the Rydberg constant for the hydrogen spectrum.
PV equals NRT. No, PV.
The ideal gas constant.
Yeah, PV equals NRT. Right. Yeah, I was like going, what? You know, I mean, I remembered all this other stuff. But that's old school. You know, he was old school from that point. It's like, you got to remember all these things out to 3 decimal places or something.
Oh, that's
like
ridiculous. That. I know in what is it, in calories and joules in that unit, it's approximately 2 and approximately 8, because it's approximately 4 between the two. But that's it. It's like 1.9872 something.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's only because I was teaching it recently.
Right,
you ask
me
next month, I will.
I know, But, yeah, that's not necessarily the most important. I think you need to remember something.
Yeah.
You know, you need to do, I mean, because if you get to the point where you're just going to look up everything.
I remember how to get here every day.
Well, there you go. Yeah, that's better than some of our faculty colleagues.
We've seen them stumbling around.
So to that end, I mean, maybe that's the thing that's going to kick off today's topic, which, believe it or not, if you look at the website.
Do we have a topic today?
Yes, we do. Okay, it's the science of cooking. And the thing is, cooking, whether it's making ice cream or cooking souffles, is something we have a great amount of empirical knowledge on, right? Do we need to take another break? Are we gonna?
No, he's going to play the key thing.
Okay, so let me set this up. So to begin with our science and technology on cooking, we actually have, I found it in the archives, lost interview with the French chef Julia Childs. I guess it was back in maybe 2000 or so, before her death.
After she died?
Ironically, it was before the show began. Okay. But we dug this up anyway. So here's an interview with Julia Childs.
Okay. Good morning, Ms. Childs. Welcome to the program. Now, what exactly will we be cooking today?
As a matter of fact, today somebody said to me, "Now, what are you going to cook today?" And I said, "Grandpa, with relish. I hope you like it." And they said, "Oh... well, you know, I never tried it, and I don't really like fish very much anyway."
Now, cooking grandpa, isn't that a felony in this state? How do you get away with something like that?
And what you can have somebody sawed in half perfectly well by the butcher, and you can just have grandpa sawed up. That would be rather fun.
Whoa, I bet you need a good stiff drink before you go into the kitchen to cook grandpa like that, don't you?
And... if you're going to do it in the exact way, you should have pot, because Grandpa, who's small mouth and a rather fat body, gives you the needed sort of gelatinous quality to the sauce. See, here this is, it's almost syrupy.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, the secret to Ms. Julia Child's success. Get a little stone, chop up Grandpa, and then cook him on up.
You're sick.
Let me now, on behalf of Radio Sandy Springs, Bill, Dave, and myself, apologize to Julia Childs, her remaining relatives, PBS, and everyone that had anything to do with the friendship, which I want to do because actually I love Julia Childs. I think she was quite cool. And what she did was so good because she took French cooking, which is almost as boring as science and technology, and made it fun because she actually had a really good sense of humor. Now, we took this out of context.
Sexy low voice, too. Yeah.
You know, she was 6'2" as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
And she had osteoporosis.
She did?
Oh, wow, really? Well, yeah, I think if you're 6'2", you just got all that height.
Yeah, right,
But in any case, I believe she was talking about cooking a pig. Grandpa was actually a pig, and she was making head cheese and all sorts of things out of this. And we actually have a link to the Julia Childs page, which gives you links to things like Her Kitchen, which is in the Smithsonian Institution now,
really?
Which is kind of nice. She's in the Museum of American History,
and
I think that's kind of neat. So she was fabulous because she kind of made it fun. That is our feeble attempt today to try to make it fun as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess cooking, there is so much science and technology in cooking. We just don't realize it because we think of it as, well, if you add the salt too early, the sauce will separate. And if you, in my case, when I make Caesar salad dressing, if you pour in the olive oil too quickly, you'll get it separated. You won't get this creamy sort of thing. And the truth is most food is all about thickening agents. It's about proteins. It's about polymerized sugars that when they interact with the right sort of way, they make it thick or thicker or not too thick or not too thin, this sort of thing.
Well, I mean, it depends on what kind of cooking. Like, I do a lot of Chinese cooking. And
So you're like me. You do everything in a wok because it's quick and easy. You just whip it in.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, like, one example is if you are trying to get, a hot, spicy dish,
mm-hmm.
you should put the peppers in the oil.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can start to smell the aroma
right.
of the peppers, then you can throw the food in. So the oil will help coat.
Oh, right. So you want the spiciness from the pepper to diffuse out into
right, or
it,
garlic or whatever.
Yeah, it's a solubility issue. It's mass
transfer. It helps
it
get into everything, yes.
Right. So maybe I ought to start with just the different ways we cook now. And let's take something simple like an oven.
Mm-hmm.
And, we've got an oven. What are we trying to do? We're trying to heat
something. Well, let's think about cooking Grandpa in the oven.
Yeah, I think she cooked him in a big pot, though. That's what she meant. I no way mean to imply that Julia Childs was a stoner. She just left off the definite article on pot when she did that. It just sounded funny to me, as it did to the guy who posted all these snippets on his website. I should put him up on the website as well. But if you think about it, when we put things in an oven, we do so to heat it. And what you need to understand, and all good cooks understand, it's the three modes of heat transfer. One is conduction, the next is convection, and the last one is radiation. And conduction, and it's the same with mass transfer, is you have a solid or a liquid, and at one end where you have a burner or some heating element or hot air, the molecules are moving around quicker, right? That's mm-hmm. what temperature is. Temperature is the average velocity of these molecules,
right?
It actually goes as the average velocity squared, but the faster they move, the greater mm-hmm. the temperature. So they're moving quick. They bump into the molecules that aren't moving quick, make them move quicker, and this front of quick-moving molecules mm-hmm. goes through it.
So conduction is when you have the heating element in contact with the thing you're trying to heat up.
Or even you can have, the surface of the hot air in the oven, but it goes through a solid or liquid at that molecular level.
Okay.
And that is slow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it takes so darn long to cook a turkey
mm-hmm.
on Thanksgiving, because it's big. Isn't a turkey probably the biggest?
18 pounds.
Aside from Grandpa.
Yeah.
A turkey is the biggest thing you put in your oven.
It's the second biggest thing I've ever cooked.
Yeah, and we don't want to know what the first is, because I'm sure that's a felony as well. In any case, so conduction is kind of slow. So convection is the other one. And convection is when it involves a fluid. And all it is you can actually have conduction
and
through a
air
fluid.
Air being a fluid as
right,
well.
Right, so air in your oven. And it when it moves. So, for example, in your oven, you usually have a heating element at the bottom, unless you're broiling.
Mm-hmm.
And that heating element heats up the air. The air gets a lower density because now it's warmer, and it starts to move up. And you get this little circulation current
mm-hmm.
in your oven. So it's not quite fair to say that your oven, if it's not a convection oven, doesn't do convection. It does.
Mm-hmm.
What it does...
Can I throw out there and ask you a question?
Sure.
We always, and I did this Thanksgiving, smoked a turkey on my grill.
Oh, okay. So you've got one of those closed smoker things?
Yeah. And, it's a Texas type and all that kind of stuff. And it'll cook the turkey much faster than cooking it in the oven.
Ooh, that's a good point.
Because I have the draft through there, so you and I smoke it. I don't put it on the flame.
Right.
Strictly smoke. But you have the draft coming through and then going out the chimney. So is that the same?
So that's exactly the principle. Is the more you circulate the air, the quicker it will cook. So so for example, in your oven you have convection, and the convection is just these natural circulations. The stuff on the top cools, it comes down, and it's usually around the sides of the turkey. So that helps. And if you can force that somehow by changing the configuration, like this flue, that can only help better. And the modern convection oven actually has a fan that actually circulates it. So the fan is forced convection, and the oven is free convection. And this is the difference between you going to McDonald's. I'm going to use McDonald's because they never have paper towels. Has anyone ever noticed that in the restrooms? They always got that hand dryer, which I hate.
Yeah.
You know, and, of course, my 7-year-old loves it because he can just, you know, put his head under it. He thinks it's great.
Yeah, they're going to be. I think the guy that invented that is the same one that invented the whiteboards we have in classrooms. We didn't need either one of these things, but they got a heck of a marketing department.
Yeah, exactly. So if you were to stand there, you'd be there for 30 minutes waiting for your hands to dry. That's free convection mass transfer, but if you put it under there, it's forced.
I usually just wipe it on somebody else's shirt when I get out of McDonald's.
Well, there you go. So you can increase convection by that, and probably the configuration of your smoker does something to force that air through more quickly, or you can put a fan in there.
We've got
as well.
Like a flue, right? So it's sort of like a chimney. It's coming in and going through.
Yeah.
So,
well, and it's bringing it's like a like the bellows in the if you're doing a fire, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you got the air coming in one end, which heats up the coals.
Yeah.
Then it goes out the other side where the turkey is and up the flue.
Right. And we know that just, you know, heat in one part versus cold in another.
And it's not in a pan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So okay. So you get better surface area.
Yeah.
Surface area is very important for heat.
Yeah, I've never done that. I've thought about getting a smoker. Do you have water somewhere in there as well?
Yeah.
One thing is steam. So you look at the heat transfer and steam condensing, and that's huge. For example, when you cook lobster, if you boil it in water, it takes friggin' forever.
Mm-hmm. But if you steam it?
If you steam it, you know, it's 20 minutes.
Right. So you've pointed out that the latent heat of vaporization for most fluids, including water, is giant.
Yeah.
So if you want to store heat or transfer heat, you don't take a fluid or a solid and heat it up and then let it cool down again. You change its phase, liquid to solid, solid to gas.
Right.
And that's why you put ice in a cooler and not cold water.
Right.
Ice absorbs a huge amount of heat. And, that, you know, when I go camping, I'll put ice in a cooler. It'll be there for 2.5 days.
Right.
I mean, so steam, that's another one.
Right.
So steaming, if it condenses on it, can transfer heat much quicker. And I know when I steam vegetables, they're done in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
Right, and that, you know, it's just, you know, a much more efficient and thorough heating process.
And here's the beauty of the steam, right? And this is what we should talk about. And this is why microwave ovens are so good. Whenever you have mass transfer, or whenever you have heat transfer, you almost always have mass transfer.
Explain what mass transfer is.
So mass transfer is just transfer of materials, just like you have transfer of energy. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when you steam something...
I thought it was a bunch of New Yorkers walking from place to the
There you go.
Yeah.
When the mass transit breaks down, you have mass transfer.
At
least I like mass transfer as a word for engineers, because you can kind of figure out what it says. Mm-hmm. We're not using words like adiabatic and fugacity. And what's a horrible electrical engineering word?
Oh, there are plenty of them.
But in any case, when you steam something, you're condensing small amounts of droplets on this, right? So you get a few droplets condensing and coming off. And every time that droplet condenses, there's material that diffuses out of the vegetable or the food into the water, and then it takes that away. Often it's certain important nutrients and things like that. So the difference between steaming it, which would kind of be sort of Asian cooking, and we have a bamboo steamer and do that a lot. The reason they say that's more healthy rather than the southern way of cooking it, which is putting it in water and boiling that okra till it's just soggy, is you're not sucking away any of the nutrients.
Why did you point at me?
Now, where are you originally from, Texas?
Yeah, I'm from Mississippi, so you're
so
out
you don't count the Texas. So do they boil vegetables till there's nothing left in Texas? No, they don't. Everything's barbecue in Texas, right?
Everything's barbecue.
Well, they don't boil it till there's nothing left anywhere in the South. They fry it.
Yeah, well, everything's fried.
I do like fried okra, I must say.
Yeah,
I have
What I was thinking about, though, as you were speaking, I wonder how many quote-unquote notable chefs know what you're talking about, and how many have just happened to trip on, well, this tastes better because I did it this way, and they have no logical...
I don't know. I don't know. And this is that fundamental versus empirical. Empirical is you know what works, but you don't know why. Fundamental is you know why. So
yeah, I don't know any great chefs to be able to say that they under. I think they understand sort of chemistry in the sense that the flavor is going to get in better by what I.
Yeah, so they understand mass transfer, you know, and heat transfer. They do understand that,
right? But they don't necessarily know that they could, you know, because they. What they really like to do is invent new dishes, so they don't know necessarily that, oh, the flavor of this would be...
Yeah, there is no science to combining flavors, which is why I'm not the greatest cook.
We do have some chefs on, and we've
we do. I listen to their shows. And we did talk about doing something together. Maybe we should do one.
We could have a cook-off. I mean, I like to cook. You know, we could have one of those things where you go out on remote. We could cook and... Yeah.
Well, so I think they have an empirical understanding of it. But, I mean, one thing I do want to talk about is leftovers, right? And I remember when I was a kid.
Now, why do you want to bring that up?
Because it impacts the use of
For Thanksgiving, we had 24 people over. We had no leftovers.
Oh, well, there you go.
Usually it's like, you know, you have the turkey omelet and the turkey soup and then the turkey sandwich. We had none of that.
Right. But for example, when I was a kid, you know, back in the 60s, early 70s, before we had microwave ovens, leftover night was the worst night of the week, right? Because you put it back in that oven, and the oven had this convection, whether it's free or forced convection with the new convection ovens today. And every time you have heat transfer, you have mass transfer, just like with the steaming. So what happens is hot air is sucking all the moisture out.
I have a weird collection of relatives in Savannah, Georgia.
Yeah.
And... we went over there. I think this was in my 20s. We went over there, and she had, you know,
green but you're from
corn.
Alabama, right?
I'm from Mississippi.
Mississippi. Let's preface this with that.
Yeah,
so
these are
weird is a whole new scale.
Oh yeah, yeah, like weird compared
weird,
to
like,
anybody
like a
in
pig
Columbus,
for me,
Mississippi.
Weird.
Yes.
Okay.
And so anyway, so we had cream stalk corn, and so I hadn't quite eaten all of it, and my aunt took my plate. And put it back in some Tupperware.
Oh, okay.
And put it back. So the leftovers were leftovers.
Had backwash mixed in.
They had. Yeah, the leftovers had been around the block.
Oh, okay. So the nice thing about radiative cooking, which is what a microwave is.
Yeah,
right?
So he's hell-bent on doing the science. But go ahead.
Yeah, we're going to do the science, whether it kills me or not. It's... basically, you bombard this thing with radiation, and it cooks very, very quickly, and there's no time for all this hot air to suck all the juices out of this material, right? Don't you remember leftover night back when you were a kid being horrible?
Yeah, yeah.
Everything was dry. But we have leftover night once a week in my house, and it's actually pretty good. I mean, it was good food the first time.
Broccoli never fares well. Explain that to me, sir.
Oh, I don't know.
If you have,
what happens to your broccoli, in your opinion?
I don't know, but I mean, if you have a Chinese dish and you had broccoli in it, everything else can end up, the carrots or whatever can taste.
Right,
the
is
water,
it all
chestnuts,
wilted and squishy?
It just tastes awful. So broccoli re-cooked, it does not work well.
Yeah, see, taste is
tough. Explain that to me.
Right, because I can't explain that to you. Taste is a function of very small concentrations of... No, I should put clothes on. Concentrations of things, and you know the thing is, when you cook stuff, you can denature those things. You can break them apart.
Well, some things are better. Like my wife makes a great spaghetti, and it's real good. She has the sauce infusing into the pasta, but instead of just plopping it on top, and the next day it's great too. So spaghetti,
I like a lot of, as long as it's nuked in a microwave.
Along with what you're talking about, the small portions that I've understood, the big words.
Uh-huh.
What about density of what you cook in? Like, my wife makes great spaghetti, too, and she just made some. But she changed pots, and it was good before, but this was the best she's ever made.
Mm-hmm.
And because she, for some reason, I don't know, put it in a bigger pot than she normally did, and it stayed and it simmered longer.
Oh.
But is there any,
Sorry.
We're falling apart.
No, I'm just reckless here.
But is there anything in density as far as...
Meaning the size thing of, you did.
Yeah.
So absolutely. And that's what chemical engineers do. Chemical engineers do nothing but take the brilliance of chemists and scale it up. And when you scale it up, everyone thinks, well, I'll just quadruple the size of the container or multiply it by 1,000. And you can't do that. And you can't do that for these simple scaling rules, namely that, say, for example, you take a reactor... And on the bench scale, it's a little beaker. And you run your reaction. It gets a little warm because it's an exothermic reaction. Gives off heat in the reaction. And then you take it and you multiply it by 10,000. The dimension, say the dimension goes up by 10,000. That means that the volume and the amount of heat you generate based on that volume goes up by 10,000 cubed, because volume goes up as the dimension cubed, right? If you take this thing, you have to multiply length, width, height, and depth.
Okay, back up. You're losing me. So let's go back to the price. So smaller pot.
Right. Yeah, so I'm not even talking about that application yet.
Okay.
But say, for example, you just have a chemical reaction. The heat transfer area to get the heat conducted out only goes up as the dimension squared, because that's area. So what happens is you tend to blow things up when you make exothermic reactions bigger. So I can't tell you exactly what happens with the pot, but what you've done is you've increased the volume more than you've increased the area for heat transfer. So maybe the heat just went in slower. Maybe it's the equivalent of slower cooking.
Yeah.
Okay, so
bigger, yeah, so size does matter. That's our lesson.
Okay, so today. a bigger pot, uh-huh, then you've got a...
Yeah, we'll slow the heat transfer.
You've got a bigger area where you're getting the conductive heating to the pot.
Right. But it hasn't increased as much as the volume of the spaghetti in it. Because one goes as the dimension cubed. One goes as the dimension squared.
So you've slowed down the heat transfer.
Right,
so it
exactly.
Simmers
so
more
this
thoroughly.
Is saying it's slower. I call it the Chuck E. Cheese effect. If you ever go in the ball crawl or those little tunnels.
Was he a famous chemical engineer?
Indeed he was.
Chuck E. Cheese.
If you've ever been to one of those little things with your kid where you crawl in the tubes with them.
I've forgotten this.
My
kids are 11 and 13.
Tubes?
Yeah, well, yeah. Particularly when other kids had
gotten stuck.
Yeah, I'm not talking about leaving, you know, germs.
Yeah, they left
and boogers and stuff.
Remnants of themselves.
Boogers would be the...
Their scent.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
The point is that as you get, you know, as you grow, your volume and hence your mass goes up as the dimension you've changed cubed.
Don't get personal, man.
It's to the fourth power. Whereas the surface area of your kneecaps only goes up as the dimension squared. That's why there's a limit to the size of land animals we can have on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can only, it's exactly that scaling thing. So when you have to cook something in
is
big
that what
vats. Yeah, that's exactly what you asked.
I think we're so far off from what David actually wanted to know.
But that's why cooking in industrial scale is completely different than cooking on the stove. You actually have to allow for these differences in heat transfer.
So, that's interesting. So when I cook rice, if I change the size of the pot.
A big rice cooker versus
a small. The 20 minutes may not give me the same quality rice.
No. And the problem is, the bigger you make it, the more non-uniform it is, and you're more likely to burn the rice at the bottom. Do you do that?
Yeah.
So a smaller one.
But that's an interesting, what you're just saying, interesting too, from the standpoint of back to our chef and what they know and what they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can't cook the first thing, that you're trying a new recipe or something, or you're trying to come up with a new recipe.
Yeah.
Well, you can't cook necessarily for 50 people trying a new recipe. So it may turn out great for a onesie-twosie, but then it tastes like garbage.
Yeah, you might be able to go 5-6, but you try to do it for 20, this is what
chemical
engineers
do. And that's largely because the proportions aren't linear.
Right.
So
go
the
up
size
is a different power, right?
So you have, you know, you got 50 people you're serving, so you're cooking it, and larger quantities, so you've got one, these things going to mix in that total volume, and then you've got the heating conductive surface versus the convective
area. And the same is true. If you put your ingredient at one location for it to diffuse throughout something bigger, it's going to take longer as well. So
interesting.
That's and it might not be a linear relationship.
Right.
So. But I think most of these chefs, they
and
know.
And linear relationship means if you double, you got
if you
four people coming
thing,
over instead of two, you multiply everything by two, it doesn't taste exactly the same.
And if it goes as the second power, as you double it, it goes up
four.
By four.
Right.
This is what much of engineering does.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you may be right, Dave, that most of these chefs, they know, for example, that if they want to thicken a sauce, and I know this, so if you're doing stir fry and you want that sauce a little thickened, you make yourself a little paste of cornstarch, and you throw it in there and thicken it. And they also know that flour works well, because when you put particles in a fluid, it thickens it, period. That's a fundamental principle of colloid science. And when I say colloid, is just a fancy word for really small particles.
Nanotechnology.
That's all it is. But the point is, the cornstarch works better, and actually we still argue about why the cornstarch works better, because it's mainly a polysaccharide. It's mainly starch. Starch is these little six-membered rings of sugars glued together.
It's in first grade with a polysaccharide.
Right. And what happens is you get just the particle part of the flour doing it, but the flour also has a lot of protein and not just this starch. The starch actually has a lot of hydroxyl and acid groups that can interact with other things in there, other proteins, other starch particles, and it tends to glue itself together.
You're making me hungry.
Yeah, and that's why cornstarch works so well. And you actually have to heat it up a little bit to get the particle to break apart a bit.
But usually, I mean, you put a little water in a bowl separately.
Yes, you do.
And mix it in. If you just sort of dump the cornstarch,
then it doesn't work at all, because then it will clump together.
Right.
You want it dispersed.
Right.
And the best example is Jell-O. So Jell-O is, instead of a polysaccharide, instead of a sugar, it's a protein. And proteins can do this. And Jell-O literally forms a gel. And a gel is nothing more than some long linear molecule called a polymer that is cross-linked with other polymers. And if you cross-link it enough so that all the polymers are cross-linked to everything else, it forms one giant molecule. And then you swell it with some solvent, either some sort of gelatinous material or a liquid. And that's what your Dr. Scholl's "I'm gelling like Magellan" insoles are. And that's what that thing you have on your desk to prevent the carpal tunnel syndrome is. And all it is a gel. And in the old days, you guys remember the old Airwick solids?
Sure.
And you pull the cap off. That was a gel swollen with probably some alcohols and other nice-smelling chemicals. And it would the chemicals would diffuse out. And then what do you have at the end? This gel all shriveled up. So that was the molecule without the solvent.
Hmm.
That's exactly what Jell-O is. Jell-O is nothing more than you take collagen protein, which comes from Grandpa, from Julia Child's thing. It comes from pig snouts and ears and hooves. Mucilage, the glue, not much different. That's really where it comes from. So they take this collagen protein, which forms a weird triple helix. So it's soluble in water. But what happens is when you heat it up, the triple helix breaks apart. All the individual strands then move around, and they can associate and form this giant cross-linked network. And what happens is it's a gel of collagen protein swollen with water. And if you let it sit, has anyone ever let Jell-O sit for a while? It'll look like that Airwick solid, right?
Yeah.
It shrivels up into this shriveled thing. And the funny thing is most cooks will tell you that...
In our house, that's called ready to eat.
There you go. Most cooks will tell you that they know you can't freeze Jell-O to make it go quicker. And the reason why is that it takes some time for these denatured proteins to then reassemble. And you'll freeze the ice crystals quicker than getting the gel. So that's why it's got to go in the fridge. So maybe the take-home lesson here is we should do another show with these guys. This is really advanced material science, what foods do. It is very complicated.
The old thing about somebody... You know, I cook the turkey in this size pot because grandma did, and her grandmother before her. It turns out there is something to that.
Yeah, and actually chemical engineers do work on the scale up of industrial food preparation.
There you guys. Have
it. Interesting.
And that's our conclusion. All right, so we have no idea what we have next week.
We're hoping to get 2 weeks
we have Mark Gosdell. He's going
to
be here.
Yeah, we're hoping to get... Nicole Lydon from CDC.
Where we'll be much more organized in our topic, which will be...
Behavioral science related to prostitution in New Orleans.
In New Orleans. Well, that's a riveting topic. Well, we'll see you next week on Inside the Black Box here on Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 AM and RadioSandySprings.com.